everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
All right. Good morning, Discovery. My name is Zach. I'm one of the pastors here and delighted to get to be with you this morning for our teaching. Wanted to catch us up a little bit. We are in the middle of a series that we're doing on the book of Luke, but studying the book of Luke through different cultural perspectives. And when we look at global theologies, it's kind of like traveling together, like going on vacation. The more that you see, the more that you're aware of how much you don't know. And also, the bigger that the world gets, as does your delight and your curiosity and your wonder at it all. And I find often, at least for me, when I learn more of the world, my love for people and the God who made it also continues to grow. In week one of this series, Jake shared about honor and shame culture, which is super prevalent in Asia and Africa and the Middle East. And we looked at the story of Zechariah and Elizabeth as they were expecting their first child who would become John the Baptist through this lens of honor and shame. Last week, we took a dip into 1960s Third World Peru to watch how they were looking at the church global and saying, you have the right kind of thinking, but your actions don't back it up. And if we're going to be honest, these things must align. And hopefully a fun kick into the complicated and good world of liberation theology. Now, to be clear, as we're continuing to move through this series, if you're wondering, so at Discovery, are we saying that truth is relative and it just depends on your perspective? Are we saying that there's an absolute truth in Scripture or not? We do believe in an absolute truth. There's no question about that. But what we are saying is that while we can be seeing that absolute truth, it doesn't mean that we see all of it simply from the particular perspective or culture that we stand in. And frankly, there's a gift in taking the shoes of some friends and standing in them for a while going, how much more does God travel? Or do I travel in my perspective of him when I consider a different angle? As I was prepping for this particular week, my friend Jake introduced me to what is now one of my new favorite hashtags. I don't spend a lot of time in hashtag world, but man, this really got me. Have you ever seen this hashtag, explain a film plot badly? Has anybody seen this before? Man, this is just, okay, so for example, you might see a line like this, and you just have to guess the plot line. Chocolate factory owner lures five kids to his factory, killing four and selecting the survivor to carry on his dark legacy. Right away, the first two words, you're like, I got an idea. Hey, that's hilarious that that's how we're going to boil down Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, okay? So getting ready for this week, you know, it'd be really fun. We should play a game. We should play a game together. So what I'm going to ask you to do is this. Look to the, like, maybe one or two people that are around you. Make sure you've got a group because you're going to need a team for this. Not everybody can do this. And probably, I think we're going to play a game. Nancy, do we have some, like, cheesy 1980s game show music that we can play? Do we have... Oh, yeah. Okay, great. Okay, what's going to happen is on the screen, you're going to see a movie, a film plot explained badly. And with your team, you only have about 4 or 5 seconds. You've got to figure out what the movie is. Okay, here we go. First one. Depressed, widowed father teams up with a mentally challenged woman to find his disabled son. What is it? What is it? You don't just if you said Finding Nemo, you're in there. Okay. Let's keep going. An old man forces a small person into a volcano. What's the movie? There's a lot of blank stares. We're not doing great at the game. How about The Lord of the Rings? Yes? Okay, this may be my favorite. A love triangle between an 18-year-old girl, a 100-year-old guy, and a dog. What do you got? This is why the team helps. You're going to need some diversity on your team to win at this. If you said Twilight, the Twilight series, you're barking up the right tree. Genetically modified frogs cause a big ruckus. What do you got? Some of you have this nailed. Jurassic Park? Is Jurassic Park the answer on the table? There it is. Okay, now this one will be fun. A deadbeat dad tries to get his son to take over the family business. And that could be a lot. Let me give you another one. This is same movie. Brave disabled war veteran single-handedly takes on a group of armed thieves. Same movie. What do you got? We need some more help. Okay, one more hint. A talking frog convinces his son to kill his dad. Same movie. You got it? There's so many. Okay, one last clue. An incestuous siblings defeat their angry father with glow sticks. We got it now? We got it now? Star Wars. You got it. You got it. All right. Kill the music. That's the game. Y'all, jump on Pinterest, wherever you need to go. Film plots explained badly. Hilarious. I had so much fun this week. I should have spent more time preparing the sermon. And I cheated because it kind of felt like I was. It's not that any of those plot lines are bad. I think it's a poor moniker, actually. I'd say the hashtag's all wrong. It's more like tell a film plot brilliantly. Reducing 2 hours of narrative to a sentence and being funny at the same time is so delightful. And certainly, we should all try and do it. It would be funny, whatever the next movie is that you watch, just consider, how could I boil this down to like a phrase and see what goes on there? This week, our teaching is anchored in a series of parables, which is a Bible word for fables. They're stories that Jesus told that weren't necessarily intended to be like, here's a real event that happened, but it's a story that's trying to explain something. And Jesus tells these stories in the book of Luke in chapter 15. And certainly, the way we often read these stories is good. It just might not be all. And so what may be the one-liner that we reduce these parables to? What more may be waiting for us? I'm going to read the entirety of Luke chapter 15. It's only 30-ish verses, but I think if we're going to have a good look at this teaching, we've got to see all of it in context. Also for today, for the sake of time, we're only going to be able to read through it once, so highly recommend returning back to this if you have time later today or this week. And it says this, again, this is a lot of text, and they're also like stories, like parables. You may want to just close your eyes and imagine these. Totally up to you. They'll be on the screen too. Verse 1, by this time, a lot of men and women of questionable reputation were hanging around Jesus, listening intently. The Pharisees and religion scholars were not pleased, not at all pleased. They growled, he takes in sinners, he eats meals with them, treating them like old friends. Their grumbling triggered this story. Suppose one of you had 100 sheep and lost one. Wouldn't you leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the lost one until you found it? When found, you can be sure you would put it across your shoulders, rejoicing. And when you got home, call in your friends and neighbors saying, celebrate with me, I found my lost sheep. Count on it. There is more joy in heaven over one sinner's rescued life than over 99 good people in no need of rescue. Or imagine, a woman who has 10 coins and loses one. Won't she light a lamp and scour the house, looking in every nook and cranny until she finds it? And when she finds it, you can be sure she'll call her friends and neighbors. Celebrate with me. I found my lost coin. Count on it. That's the kind of party God's angels throw every time one lost soul turns to God. And then he said, there was once a man who had 2 sons. The younger said to his father, Father, I want right now what's coming to me. And so the father divided the property between them. It wasn't long before the younger son packed his bags and left for a distant country. And there, undisciplined and dissipated, he wasted everything he had. After he had gone through all his money, there was a bad famine all through that country, and he began to feel it. He signed on with a citizen there who assigned him to his fields to slop the pigs. He was so hungry, he would have eaten the corn cobs and the pig slop, but no one would give him any. That brought him to his senses. He said, all those farmhands working for my father sit down to 3 meals a day, and here I am starving to death. I'm going back to my father. I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against God. I've sinned before you. I don't deserve to be called your son. Take me on as a hired hand. And he got right up, and he went home to his father. When he was still a long way off, his father saw him. His heart pounding, he ran out, embraced him, and kissed him. The son started his speech. Father, I've sinned against God. I've sinned before you. I don't deserve to be called your son ever again. But the father wasn't listening. He was calling to the servants. Quick, bring a clean set of clothes and dress him. Put the family ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Then get a prize-winning heifer and roast it. We're going to feast. We're going to have a wonderful time. My son is here, given up for dead and now alive, given up for lost but now found. And they began to have a wonderful time. All this time, his older son was out in the field. And when the day's work was done, he came in. As he approached the house, he heard the music and dancing, and calling over one of the houseboys, he asked what was going on. He told him, "Your brother came home. Your father has ordered a feast, barbecued beef, because he has him home, safe and sound." The older brother stomped off in an angry sulk and refused to join in. His father came out and tried to talk to him, but he wouldn't listen. And the son said, "Look how many years I've stayed here serving you, never giving you one moment of grief. But have you ever thrown a party for me and my friends? Then this son of yours, who has thrown away your money on whores, shows up and you go all out with a feast." His father said, "Son, you don't understand. You're with me all the time, and everything that is mine is yours. But this is a wonderful time, and we had to celebrate. This brother of yours was dead, and he's alive. He was lost, and now he's found." Luke 15. As we would typically do here at Discovery, we'd begin by digging into the original context of the story. And today, we're going to hone in on just one of these three stories, the sheep, the coin, and these boys. And it's helpful to note before these stories that Jesus has been acting out a little bit. He's having a lot of dinners. He's going to a lot of parties. But the party guests, they were embezzlers, prostitutes, homeless folk, the spiritually lazy and the disengaged. In a word, they were the dingy kind of sinners in his community, according to the Pharisees and the scribes who were watching all this. And he's catching flack from them, who are frankly, these Pharisees and scribes, repulsed and confused by who he's chosen to be his friends. Each of these stories is chipping away at the same point, and clearly the one told with the most detail and color is the last of the three. So we'll focus on these sons. Now, the prodigal son, as this is often termed and titled, in the original audience, there would have been an audible gasp in the crowd the moment that the younger son asked for his inheritance. Much of his inheritance would have been land, which would have been passed down through generations. And it's clear that this younger son would have liquidated that land as quickly as possible. He was selling his heritage. And even worse than that, he spent it on prostitutes and partying. So disrespectful, reckless, wasteful, offensive. Not only that, but he lives in a culture where it's not normal to leave home. We live in a culture where that's absolutely the norm, but here you stayed, particularly with an intent to care for your aging parents. Abandoning a parent, that's deeply shameful. And not only this, but in asking for his inheritance, he was asking for something that culturally only came through the death of his father. So he was telling his dad, he really didn't care if he was alive or dead. He just wanted his stuff. A terrific theologian who spent most of his career in the Middle East, Kenneth Bailey, spent some time asking different communities in rural Middle East, "Here's this story. What would be a typical reaction? What would we expect of this father?" And unequivocally, the answer came back that it would have been expected for the father to beat this son, or to at very least throw him out until he learned some respect. And the fact that the father's response to this request is, "Okay," is immediately offensive and provocative. What is going on with this dad? The son leaves. He blows the stash. A famine hits. No one will help him. He finds himself feeding pigs, which to a Jewish audience wasn't just gross on a physical level, but a spiritual one too. And when he returns home, we find a father who's clearly just been scanning the horizon since the son left. And we find a father who runs, which in this culture was an undignified thing to do. It would involve picking up your robe, showing your legs, looking foolish, running through town. And again, we find a father risking for his son. There's clearly nothing that the son has done to show that he's earned a spot as a slave, let alone as a returning family member. And yet, that's exactly what he finds. His identity is not based off of merit or resources, but seemingly purely biology. "You are my boy. I made you. You belong with me." And the same statement is made to his other son, who is also struggling to come home, but for totally different reasons. And if you've grown up even close to church, let alone inside of church, you've probably heard this story more than most stories in the Bible. It is really fun to hear it told fresh from a different perspective. All these contextual pieces matter, that this is how a Middle Eastern culture would hear these things. But I think to help us understand the lens that we typically hear this story through, or that I typically hear this story through, I want to read us a story that Philip Yancey wrote down in his book, What's So Amazing About Grace. This would be, in my mind, what a typical reading of the story of the prodigal son goes like in a culture like ours here in America. He starts off the story talking about this young girl, this teenage girl who grew up on a cherry orchard in Michigan. But she had some parents who she felt were just a little too controlling, and her anger continues to boil over until one day she just decides, I'm leaving home. But I know if I run away, my parents will look for me, probably in like California or Florida. But growing up in rural Michigan, there's no way that they would consider looking in downtown Detroit. She'd gone there on a trip to go see the Detroit Tigers play baseball with her church youth group. And so she knew a spot where maybe she could make some connections and figure things out from there. As she rolls in, she meets some people. As Yancey tells the story, one guy who gives her something that makes her feel better than anything she's ever had in her life. And he teaches her some things that men like. And before long, as you can guess, this girl's story continues to unravel. Until we find now, mid-story, strung out, addicted, and now not worth as much in the ring that she used to run in. One night she lies awake, listening for footsteps. All of a sudden, everything about her life looks different. She no longer feels like a woman of the world. She feels like a little girl, lost in a cold and frightening city. And she begins to whimper. Her pockets are empty and she's hungry. She needs a fix. She pulls her legs tight underneath her and shivers under the newspaper she's piled atop her coat. Something jots a synapse of memory, and a single image fills her mind of May in Traverse City, when a million cherry blossoms bloom at once, with her golden retriever dashing through the rows and rows of blossomy trees in chase of a tennis ball. God, why did I leave? She says to herself, and pain stabs at her heart. My dog back home eats better than I do now. She's sobbing, and she knows in a flash that more than anything else in the world, she wants to go home. Three straight phone calls, three straight connections with the answering machine. She hangs up without leaving a message the first two times, but the third time she says, Dad, Mom, it's me. I'm wondering about maybe coming home. I'm catching a bus up your way, and I'll get there about midnight tomorrow. If you're not there, well, I guess I'll just stay on the bus until it hits Canada. It takes about 7 hours for a bus to make all the stops between Detroit and Traverse City. And during that time, she realizes the flaws in her plan. What if her parents are out of town and miss the message? Shouldn't she have waited another day or so until she could have talked to them? And even if they are home, they probably wrote her off as dead long ago. She should have given them some time to overcome the shock. Her thoughts bounce back and forth between those worries and the speech she's preparing for her father. Dad, I'm so sorry. I know I was wrong. It's not your fault. It's all mine. Dad, can you forgive me? She says the words over and over, her throat tightening even as she rehearses them. She hasn't apologized to anyone in years. The bus has been driving with lights on since Bay City. Tiny snowflakes hit the pavement, rubbed, worn by thousands of tires, and the asphalt steams. She's forgotten how dark it gets at night out here. A deer darts across the road and the bus swerves, and every so often a billboard, a sign posting the mileage to Traverse City. Oh, God. When the bus finally rolls into the station, its air brakes hissing in protest, the driver announces in a crackly voice over the microphone, 15 minutes, folks, that's all we have here, 15 minutes to decide her life. She checks herself in a compact mirror, smooths her hair, licks the lipstick off her teeth. She looks at the tobacco stains on her fingertips and wonders if her parents will notice if they're there. She walks into the terminal, not knowing what to expect. Not one of the thousand scenes that have played out in her mind prepare her for what she sees. There in the concrete walls and plastic chairs bus terminal that is Traverse City, Michigan, stands a group of 40
brothers and sisters and great aunts and uncles and cousins and a grandmother and a great grandmother to boot, and they're all wearing goofy party hats and blowing noisemakers taped across the entire wall of the terminal as a computer-generated banner that reads, "Welcome home." Out of the crowd of well-wishers breaks her dad. She stares out through the tears quivering in her eyes like hot mercury and begins the memorized speech. "Dad, I'm sorry. I know..." And he interrupts her. "Hush, child. We have no time for that. No time for apologies. You'll be late for the party. A banquet's waiting for you at home." I get worked up reading that, because that's my story, too. I was not a female prostitute in Michigan, just to be clear, but the story of the prodigal son, it just travels, because it's a story of radical grace. And if you've ever found yourself in your own story in a place where you're going, "I'm just so screwed up, and I don't know where to go or what to do, and there's only one good place that it feels like is an option, maybe I should just turn around and look at God in the face and say, what do you think of this mess that I've made?" And to find compassion, what a gift. If you're newer to this whole idea of Jesus, to understanding the heart of God, it's hard to make it any more clear than this story. The unconditional and unstoppable love that God has for us, the fact that he calls us children, the grace for the absolute messes we have made in our lives and the world around. It's a story that frankly just says no matter what you've done or what's been done to you, you're welcome here. And it paints that phrase in high definition. For you, it could be drugs and prostitution. It could be something more like sufficiency and money. It could be a trail of relationships you've left in your wake, or just simply trying to hold together your reputation for being good and perfect. There are a lot of ways to become lost. So no matter your story, this God is for you. He's for me. He's for all of us. The grace of God is astounding. And it's self-sacrificing, which should have been a beating. He just takes all the shame and all of the issues going on there on himself because he wants you to be with him. Come home to know that your value is not attached to what you do or what you have to show for your life. It's biology. He made you, and you're his, and he wants you home. His invitation is to stop your running and to watch his running, and to let him bring you home. Savor this. This is a good story, and it's offered to all of us. I think we can summarize this very good reading of all three of these parables, actually. They all carry the same theme with something like this. In our first reading, this is a story for the lost, for the people who are at the margins. And it's a story about realizing that we need forgiveness, that we need to be welcome home. The Christian word for this is repentance. The story ends with us being found, with receiving grace, with being moved towards by God. Why? So that I can be at God's party in heaven someday. And if I could have a plot line told poorly, or as I would say, a plot line told brilliantly, this is all about unconditional dad love. And I'd look at anyone in the eye and say, "This is a good way to read this story." But I'd also look anyone in the eye and say, "It's not the only thing that's going on here." And so as we maybe look at a second perspective today, I'd love to invite you to the perspective of a Cuban-American theologian pastor by the name of Justo Gonzalez. After undergrad and seminary in Havana, he studied at Yale, earning his master's and doctorate degrees in theology and philosophy. He then became a seminary professor, moving all over the place, spending a lot of time in Puerto Rico and Georgia, and rising as a leading voice in the Methodist Church, but is really well known for being one of the leading voices in Latino theology in the world. He wrote a book, and if we're going through this series and you're enjoying these perspectives, this is one of those books that I would say you should grab this one. It's relatively short, and it will throw you for a loop because it's all Latino perspective on reading the Bible. It is so good. So Santa Biblia, if you can find it, grab a copy. But in the first chapter, he talks about a meeting that he had with several Hispanic and Latino peers that were all trying to come together to figure out a title for a journal that they'd been writing together. And the thing was, they were struggling to figure out, what do we all have in common? Like, what's the point of this journal? Somebody said, well, we're all Hispanic. And somebody said, well, I don't like that term. I like more the term Latino. Those terms both cover a lot of ground, but we couldn't agree. And they talked about the titles that they carry, Chicanos, Puerto Ricanos, African Creole, Salvadoran. And the more they discussed, the more that they realized that the thing they had in common was that they did not have a center. And that idea helped them to see that what they held in common was that they lived with a high sense of marginality as people who felt on the edges of culture in America. And he points out a couple significant things, and I say this not as an authority in this cultural and sociological work. I say this simply as a student of Justo's. So for the Latino folks in this room, please excuse me, as I do not seek to speak on your behalf, but rather to allow a trusted teacher to speak through me. Justo says that most Latinos identify with this experience of marginality, of always feeling on the outside. And first, he says, because we live in a polycentric society, most Latinos will stand at the margin in some relationships, but will actually also stand in the center of some others. So for example, Latinos often experience standing at the margin of the dominant culture or political trends in American society. However, some who may be more educated or male or wealthy stand at the center of some relationships in their lives. Also, he's quick to point out that some marginality is sometimes self-imposed. He gives the example that in the early church, many Roman believers would intentionally not participate in the cultural norms of their time because they would be practices of immorality or idolatry. This early church was full of folks who intentionally put themselves at the margins simply because of what they believed. And he looks at his Latino and Hispanic brothers and sisters and says, we do the same thing. So much of Latino culture is Roman Catholic. And so when you choose to be Protestant as a Latino, you find yourself in the margins. However, you're not only finding yourself on the margins of your Roman Catholic friends, but often, as Gonzalez points out, because you're choosing to be a part of a Protestant church, you're often choosing to be a part of a church community where you're also a minority. And these are self-imposed margins, but nonetheless margins that are experienced over and over and over again. And because of this, it begins to teach an approach to life, or in today's case, an approach to Scripture, where the lens is from the outside looking in. So for Justo, reading the parables in Luke 15 yield a little bit of a different perspective. He says this in his book, but there's another angle to all these parables. According to Luke, they're not originally spoken to evil, sinful, unclean people. Luke tells us that the Pharisees and the scribes, that is, the best religious people of the time, and those who knew the best the scripture, were grumbling because Jesus was welcoming sinners and eating with them. It is at this juncture that Jesus told them, the Pharisees and the scribes, this parable. And the three parables are not originally addressed to the lost, but to those who feel left out because Jesus is eating with the lost, to those who have never been lost. He's not speaking to the one lost sheep, but to the 99 that the shepherd leaves in the wilderness in order to go look for the one. He's not speaking to the lost coin that the woman searches until she finds, but to the other nine that remain safely in her purse. He's not speaking to the prodigal son who has gone to the distant country, but to the elder son who has been serving his father all these years, resenting that he is working like a slave, and yet he doesn't even get a young goat to celebrate a dinner with his friends. In short, Jesus is not speaking to the margin, but to the center. He's not merely speaking of God's love for the margin, but he is speaking to those who think they belong at the center, telling them that unless they too go out and seek the lost sheep and the lost coin and welcome the younger brother, they are not true servants of this God. Justo's point here is that this is not a story that is primarily about grace, at least how we would read it through somebody like Philip Yancey, although that's absolutely some of it. If you can make that one of your one-line plots, you're doing good. These stories are about grace. But he's simply pointing out who these stories were told to. Initially, these were for the religious elite, for those who would consider themselves found, the most Jewish of Jews, or in this case today, the most Christian-y of Christians, and some other clues suddenly may begin to catch our interest. If this is a story about sheep and coins, it's a bit ironic that the shepherd throws a party and that the lady who finds a coin throws a party. Because in this day and age, you throw a party by having a lot of food. And if you're a shepherd, you're going to have sheep. So you find a lot of sheep and you throw a party and you kill a sheep. And if you lost a coin but you're going to throw a party, you've got to spend the coin. It's not about the sheep or the coin. It seems like these stories are about the party. And all of this, it's by no chance, is taking place in a time where Jesus is being criticized for how many parties that he's going to, particularly with the people that he's partying with. So the question seems to be pointed at anyone who's reading this story. Will you choose to party when God finds things, when God finds people, when God welcomes people at the margins of culture? What if you're bothered by their morals or their politics, the fact that they park their car on their lawn or they dress in expensive clothes, what they believe about gender or sexuality, the way that they follow Jesus? Will you party if God finds them? And the story of the sons is the longest and seems to carry with it the driving point. It's really a story about the oldest son. And we're left at the end wondering, what's his response? I don't know if you caught it, but it ends with this great tension of God saying, come inside, this brother of yours was lost, but now he's found. He's dead, but he's alive. End scene. And we're just left wondering, what's he going to do? And the implicit invitation to the reader is, what are you going to do? Or will we remain indignant? Will we look at the center of our beliefs? And will we deem what's acceptable and agonizing over the things that the younger brothers in our lives are not measuring up to? And perhaps if we dive a bit deeper, can we just become awestruck at the effort that God seems to be willing to go through to go finding? If we would just compare these two readings side by side, it really does start to paint some pretty cool and distinct pictures. This is a story for the supposedly never lost, for those at the center. It's a story about celebrating each RSVP to the party, this idea of you belong, the Christian word evangelism. This is a story about being thrilled, about showing wonder at whatever God's doing, because God wants me to love everybody. And I can be at everyone's party here on earth. And if there's a plot line told brilliantly here, party at the rescue station, RSVP, ? Can you see the difference between these two readings? Both are so good to consider. But when we take the perspective of those who read the Bible from the margins, who live their lives on the margins, suddenly perhaps we get to see the story with a bit more color. And even more than that, we get to see God in a bit more color too. We have a really cool opportunity today to party. This last summer, our friends Bob and Susan Combs, who serve with Navigators in Compton, California, asked us to pray. The last 8 years, they've been running an internship program for their kids out there. Really, this internship is based around a series of workshops. They'll hit everything from financial literacy to relationship skills, cooking, agriculture, screen printing t-shirts, team building, home improvement, leadership development. Every student that's a part of this program gets one day where they lead their cohort, their team. And the whole idea is we're trying to help you find your places of passion, your strengths. The kids that are a part of this, they are loved and seen. Many of them report, like, I can just show up and I don't have to carry a facade. I don't have to have the labels. I just get to be me here. They typically have around 60 young people, college age, some high school, and it's a paid internship. It's rare that that money for these kids is going towards an Xbox. Pretty typical that it's going towards groceries for their family, paying bills, helping a sibling get a pair of shoes. And it's an anchor for the ministry that they do the rest of the year. So they'd call at the beginning of the summer and they said, hey, we've had this program. It really fuels what we do. But we've relied on those finances coming from a grant that we get from the state of California, and they changed some of the qualifications this year, and we don't qualify anymore. And so we're looking at potentially shutting this down. Join us in prayer. And for those that were here this summer, we shared this story with you. And that first weekend, we raised $28,000. And Katie Moeller, who works with all of our local and global partnerships, excitedly got to call Bob and say, it's not the $70,000 that you're looking for, but it's something. Can we get a couple kids? And that weekend, Bob says, we decided not to cancel it, but it was still very uncertain what was going to happen. When he asked Susan, she was not uncertain. She was like, I feel real good. God's coming through. Like, she's on another level. I love Susan Combs. But the next 2 weeks, we here got to raise another $58,420. And that was combined with some money that they were raising from a couple other places. They did it this summer. They put on this internship program. Day one, Bob was surprised. A whole group home of boys showed up, seemingly unannounced, hoping to be accepted into this program. And Bob and Susan were able to say yes, because we've got the funds to be able to do it. This summer, they learned how to fix water heaters, how to grow food in the local community garden, how to paint homes, how to work in teams. But they also learned how to care for each other. They learned how to lead a group for a day. They learned how to explore scripture for themselves under the mentorship of navigators. And Bob often says this program, this type of community is really hard to form without the dignity of a job and the culture both coming together. It's not just practical life skills. It's about emotional and relational and spiritual skills all coming together. And what's the catalyst? Sure, it's about the dignity of a paycheck. That plays in. But the catalyst really is a God who unites a bunch of suburbanites in North Denver in love with a bunch of urban youth workers to accomplish something he loves doing. He just loves going finding. So that group home, Bob said, every one of those boys became a follower of Jesus this summer. Another one of the kids said, this is the first time in my life I don't feel alone. Many of these students want to get involved in other work and other ministries. They're jumping in with church partners that Bob and Susan have. I want to show you a short clip of a video that they sent us this last week, but I want to be careful as we watch this. Bob will be thanking us, but I think we can be honest and recognize that, sure, we got to be a part of this. But the real thanking, the real party, the real wonder is not a bunch of dollars that we sent their way. The beauty and the truth and the goodness is that God is up to something in the margins of their world and in the margins of my world. And we sometimes get to be close enough to it that we can hear the party music bumping through our own walls. So if you enjoy watching this, perhaps the lingering question becomes, what other parties could God be inviting you to join in on? But as you watch, there's an 11-minute clip that we'll send out in an email later this week if you want to watch the whole thing. Here's just such a small taste. Let's party as we watch.
I think, again, discovering church, this couldn't have happened without you. I can't tell you how grateful we are. Thank you so much for what you guys were able to make happen here. The partnership we have, I know Colorado's a long ways away from us, and we don't see each other that often, but we are partners, and the things that happen here are because you guys help things happen. The prayer support, the financial support, the relationships, they make these things happen.